Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And today I have another special guest on the podcast who has a very interesting story, life story, and a lot of amazing lived experiences to share with us today. And Dennis, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast, and I'm going to ask you to say your last name because I don't want to get it wrong. So welcome, Dennis.
Oh, thank you, Mona. I'm delighted to be here. And my last name is Vizhakovsky.
Awesome. So Dennis, I know there's a lot of information that you're going to share today and a lot of great things we're going to talk about today that I know are going to be really helpful to the listeners. But I'd love if you could share a little bit about what you're doing now, the work you're doing now, and maybe a little bit about your journey to understand that you are autistic and maybe some of the highlights that you think might be helpful for the listeners to know as we begin our conversation.
Oh, wow. That's a mouthful there. So I'm going to have to have you guide me through that.
Sure.
Just a little bit about me. I've learned recently, only over the past 8 years in being in a relationship with my fiance, that I would tell a lot of details about whatever I'm talking about, and most people do not want to hear the details. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give bullets of my journey just to give the audience a sense of my personal experience. That would be easier for me. And even though it's bullets, it doesn't take away or minimize what I've gone through. It's that I've gone through healing as well, so I can say this easily.
Mm-hmm.
Mona, first, I always start off with my story. My first experience of awareness around me was at 4 years old when I experienced what I considered the presence. It was this loving, compassionate, beautiful, non-judgmental experience of what I would call a higher power now, or God. But back then, I only knew it as the presence. And the reason why that is significant is because of the trauma that I endured throughout my life. That presence was the only stable factor in my life that enabled me to know that I am loved unconditionally.
Mm.
And so I was neglected as a child. I was diagnosed as being an autist in probably 2014 or 2015. So nobody knew this about me. However, as a child, I spent most of my day, 6 to 8 hours a day, in a rocking chair, just being within myself, and I'm talking since I was 3 years old up until I was 18.
Mm.
My parents didn't understand that I was on the spectrum, nor did they pay attention to me. So I was pretty much alone that whole time and felt extraordinarily lonely. But I had this presence with me that I dare to say, oftentimes entertained me as a child. Then later on in life, when I turned 13, I met this brother, a Catholic brother, who talked about the Judeo-Christian God and the experience of my past, or the God of my understanding. I identified with what this brother was talking about, and which led me to understand that the God of my understanding was very much like the Judeo-Christian God.
Mm.
So while I'm in that place of sharing about this man who introduced me to the Judeo-Christian God, he also moved into my parents' house, and my parents allowed him to sleep in my room. And from the time I was 13, he raped me over 900 times.
Oh, my gosh.
So I share that. It's easy for me to share that now because I've already gone through the experience of forgiving the man, of letting go. But then I had to spend the rest of my life trying to understand how that affected me, and even understanding that how traumatic that was. So I then that man who raped me, he consequently was the superior of the monastery that I joined, and the abuse continued in the monastery until I built the courage to say no, which was a very difficult word for me to use. So that's what brought me to where I am now, where everything that happened in my past, I found somehow as a gift. I looked at it as something's being revealed, or something's being taught, or something good will come out of it. And that's what moved me through to where I am now, writing my autobiography and my book about what does love look like.
Wow. Dennis, you know, my eyes are tearing up. I know you've shared with me, you know, a little bit of about your story before, but I can't even imagine what that young child felt like. You know, the loneliness, being in the rocking chair, having parents that don't understand who you are and what you need, and then having somebody that you felt a connection with, you know, traumatize you and rape you over and over and over again. And just, I know there are others who are listening to your, you know, brief introduction to just the extensive trauma you had, and they're relating on some level, because I hear this over and over again from autistic individuals and non-autistic individuals when they understand how traumatic certain things were in their life. They understand also how it's colored their relationships, whether it's family relationships or intimate relationships with a partner. And you said you've been on a healing journey, and that is, you know, so critical for those of us who've experienced trauma, because if we don't heal, we do spend our lives suffering. And I love that you're willing to share so vulnerably, but, you know, my heart goes out to that young Dennis and that 13-year-old Dennis. And I just appreciate you being so vulnerable and sharing that with the audience. I really do.
Thank you, Mona. There's so many concepts that I understand now I didn't understand when I was younger. And when I was diagnosed as being on the spectrum, it was while I was at my monastery in Venice, Italy. And one thing I learned is, one, that autism is a gift, and I look at my autism as a gift, and that I'm grateful for everything that happened to me in my past. I say that hesitantly, because it's not that I wanted to, it's not that I'm happy that it happened, but it created the person I am today, and it just blessed me in so many ways. I wouldn't, if I could go back in time, I wouldn't change anything. Now, I couldn't say this about anybody else but myself, but since it's happened to me, this is my experience. This is my truth. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to start off with. I'm grateful. While at the same time, when I hear of other children being abused, my blood boils, because of the understanding I do have of what it does to a child, or what it can do to a child.
Sure, sure. And I'm a social worker. I've spent many, many years working in child welfare, and, you know, I've seen it firsthand. I had to get out of the child welfare direct service work when I had my child, because I just couldn't do it anymore. So I understand the empathy and, you know, the feelings that you have towards others. And I also hear you about, you know, kind of feeling like some of this is a gift that has helped you become the person that you are today. And you're helping others in so many ways. And you have, I know, throughout your career and the work that you've done. I would love it if you could share you know, what brought you to go for an autism diagnosis in your adult years? You said 2014, 2015. What were you experiencing, if you don't mind sharing, or what were you noticing, or what were other people telling you? You know, how did you move forward on that, or what made you move forward on that?
Sure. There's two parts to that. First, you know, when I use the word God, I mean the universe. That my understanding of God is it's beyond what how religion describes God, because the God of my understanding is non-judgmental and compassionate and alive and is part of my every waking and sleeping moment. So I just want to clarify that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was diagnosed, it was, again, another gift. I was in my monastery, and my superior at that monastery wanted me to meet who I thought was a friend of his. So a friend of his is a friend of mine. I met this woman. Her name is Jane. And Jane and I just went up and hugged her. I didn't think, you know, if it's a friend of Father Roberto, then I have to embrace her like she's my own friend. And we sat in the monastery for a cup of coffee, and it lasted 3 hours. And she, I was able to see her heart and tell her things about herself that literally brought her to tears. And she clarified that what I saw was accurate. But then she did the same for me, and I didn't know her background. And she began to explain to me, and she asked me first, do you know that you're autistic? And I was shocked, never considered myself that. Then the ensuing 2.5 hours, she started to explain basic experiences that autists have that she had already observed in the short period of time she was talking to me that she saw within me.
Mm-hmm.
This began a relationship over time. And the gift of that was there were so many voids in my awareness of the world around me that I just could not understand. I could not, well, basic, I couldn't understand social cues.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand why you need boundaries that made no sense to me. When you love from your heart, why do you need boundaries? So there was that naivete to my development and not understanding these things as most people develop an understanding at ages, you know, 5, 6, 3, whatever the time span. And then she went on to spend 1.5 years going over 42 concepts that basically autists don't understand. And that opened up my world even more so. It was painful because it also brought back memories of understanding. But that was the gift that she gave me. And then when I came to the United States, back to the States, I was requested by my PCP to get a diagnosis here in the United States from another person, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I pursued that. But then understanding them on the spectrum just opened my world and enabled me to truly love myself as I am and to let go of the challenges that I had that just caused me to stop talking or not interact with people. So it's like it gave me a new lease on life.
It sounds like it did. And thank you so much for sharing that. And I really wonder, and I don't know if you have thought about this, but I'd love to ask, did you feel like in the monastery that you could be yourself more than outside the monastery? Was it a good place, relatively speaking, for you to explore the things that were your passions or the way in which you wanted to be in the world?
Well, that's a very good question. My monastery was extraordinarily dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that my superior was still raping me while I was in the monastery is an indication of the manipulation, the coercion, and the controlling that was going on in my monastery. However, I don't know if it's my nature or my drive to want to be loved to love and to be loved caused me to always question. And so I questioned everything that was happening in the monastery, and I was not liked for it. I was actually shamed for my continuous questioning, but I didn't allow the questioning to prevent me, or the shaming to prevent me from following my heart. But then I dare to say in 2013, I saw a program, and it touched me so deeply. I remember I was in my monastery. I just happened to be alone. I stood up in the living room, and I said, from this day forward, I shall be fearless to be me.
Wow.
And it was 3 years of epiphanies and understanding. And then it was thereafter that I met Jane, who helped me understand that I was on the spectrum. So this journey of being fearless to be me and then discovering them on the spectrum was all gift, because it gave me more understanding of the power of being who I am. I am, and I believe everyone holds a spark of God inside of them. Whatever you consider that higher power, it's not the God of religion, but this non-judgmental, compassionate being. We all have a spark. Unless we are fearless to be who we are, that spark will not be shown, and people will not see it. And then I also understood, I began to understand, if I choose to be myself, I will attract people who will like me for who I am and not the person that I was hiding.
Dennis, that is so powerful and such an important message, because one of the things that I often hear from late diagnosed or self-identified autistic folks is that they've probably masked their entire life without knowing it. And in many situations, they were afraid to be their authentic self. And when they have knowledge of their, you know, how their brain works, their neurodiversity, and they realize that they've been masking, all they want to do is take off the mask. And I don't blame anybody for that. And I love fearless to be me. How beautiful. And wouldn't it be great if we could all have that mantra or motto, and we only attract people in our lives who want to be with our authentic self, appreciate, value, and love our authentic self. But I think it starts with us, right? We have to be the love that we want from outside.
Right, Mona, it's essential to coming into that healthiness of life that we choose to be fearless to be who we are. And that fearlessness, and this is why the book on the 15 attributes of love was so important to me, because not only did I need to be fearless, but I also needed a guideline to tell me what does love look like. And then with the attributes of what does love look like, there's always accountability and responsibility. It's universal. It always works, but it can only work under these values. And that's what changed my life, to the point that now I have severed every relationship that I've ever had that was toxic, or that was whatever it may have been, to the point that most of my family, I have no relation. Because my healthiness, my desire, my passion, my motto to be love, to love and to be loved, cannot happen when I'm allowing people around me to truly not be loving me objectively, because that directly affects my own person, and it becomes a burden, and it weakens me, and it tired me.
Sure.
And now I'm free of that.
I love that. And sometimes this is the hardest thing, Dennis, and even couples who are in neurodiverse relationships who talk about, you know, that they don't feel that their partner accepts their authentic self. And then, you know, even if you love your partner, if they can't accept your authentic self, it will cause suffering. It will probably cause physical and mental health issues. So I think what you said is just so profound and so important and valuable for folks to not only hear, but find a path forward to live, you know, being fearless to be themselves, their authentic selves, and have people in their lives that accept them as that. Yeah, we shouldn't have to change, you know, our core essence for anybody. So I really appreciate that. And I'd love to talk about the 15 attributes of love, because I know you're in the middle of writing your book, What Does Love Look Like? So I'd love to hear maybe a little bit more about what drew you to start writing the book. And then let's talk a little bit about the 15 attributes.
Absolutely. Mona, I found that, you know, I had, you know, here I am. Now I'm going back to my monastery days, and I loved people. And because I never received or hardly ever received any affection from my family, from those who are supposed to love you, I was extraordinarily needy. And I'm sure you've heard of the old studies that were done in Russia on child babies that were born, and whether someone held them or not held, those that were held lived, those that weren't held, they be isolated, they stopped crying, and many of them would die.
Yep.
And so here I am as a child, starving for physical touch. So I'm starving for that energy, which led me to be a perfect victim of a perpetrator because of that neediness. But once I got through that and understood that I was missing some things, I started therapy, I needed to develop some type of mechanism that could help me overcome what I couldn't do. Like I have a very difficult time recognizing social cues.
Mm-hmm.
So this naturally came to me because I found in my own study. So I have a bachelor's in psychology and religious studies, a master's, again, in religious studies and spirituality. I have over 52 courses I've taken across the country in spirituality, assessment interviewing. So I had this plethora of a background that gave me information that enabled me to say there are universal principles that govern the world.
Mm-hmm.
Religion sometimes has a way of expressing them, but sometimes they're not expressed in their original context. So there could be some manipulation. And I find that oftentimes on the bad side of religion, religion uses the context of, like, say, the Bible as a weapon. They weaponize elements to control, where religion is only supposed to be like a boundary to help us develop a moral spiritual consciousness.
Mm.
So in any case, I needed something for myself. And when I was in the monastery, we prayed 5 to 6 hours a day. Two of those hours were meditation. And during that time, I would get these ideas of what looked like. And I found it particularly in the Bible, Corinthians 1:13, there are 15 attributes. However, these attributes are universal. They cross barriers of culture and belief. And every attribute you can use up against Gandhi and how he lived his life, or Rumi, or the Buddha, or Teresa of Calcutta. That's how universal these 15 attributes are. I just happened to find them.
Mm-hmm.
In the New Testament.
Yeah, and I think if we as a society and we as individual people were more in tuned to these attributes of love that we're going to talk about in our relationships with ourselves and with others, oh my gosh, it would be a game changer for everybody. So let's talk about, let's go maybe three at a time so we can have a little discussion about them. Let's start with the first three attributes.
Sure. So what I did in the writing is I used anecdotes. Like, for example, for me, the epitome of love would be like a Gandhi or a Jesus, Rumi, Buddha, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And that is like the perfection of objective love. Mm-hmm. Then on the other side, the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. And so I took stories from Nero or Pol Pot, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Leopold II of Belgium. I used their behaviors to, again, be the anecdote of the opposite of love. Mm-hmm. So when we go into the attributes of love, one, the first attribute is patience. Well, if you have Mother Teresa on one end and Hitler on the other, and you're looking at what is patience, I literally devised a scale of 1 to 10. The idea is with this scale, if we have 15 attributes and the scale is 1 to 10, when you add up your numbers at the end, it's going to give you a continuum of where you find yourself on that love scale, or you find somebody else. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think it's because of years of being in the monastery, I'm a very patient person. I give people plenty of time and room to be human. But then there's, again, these attributes are always accompanied by accountability and responsibility. So for myself, I hold myself to a place where I choose to be patient. And when I lose my patience, I apologize. So we have an understanding of what patience is. We're willing to wait for someone. We're willing to give people time if they need it. Again, being reasonable and, again, using objective truth, there's a guide to, if you're being accountable and responsible and you have a job and it needs to be done in 15 minutes, and someone does it in 16, so you're patient. It's within the guidelines of accountability and responsibility. But if it's over the timeline, the designated timeline, accountability and responsibility moves you to hold that person accountable for not staying within the parameters of what was expected or appropriate for whatever the task was. That's where the patience comes in. I could have been on the patience scale, I could have been a 9, which is close to Mother Teresa. Well, I had to hold that person accountable and responsible, which means I have to be assertive. I have to tell them the truth. Mm-hmm. I have to say that they've gone over the boundaries of this situation and it's not acceptable.
Yeah. And I think, Dennis, I think the patience piece is a piece that for me was continually challenged in my 30-year marriage. And I hear it often from neurodiverse couples because both partners have such different perspectives. Both partners have such different timelines for processing things. And so I think as we go through each one of the 15 pieces, then maybe we can even talk a little bit, or maybe I'll bring it up, what the lesson might be or the opportunity for growth might be for a neurodiverse couple, whether it's one partner or both partners where they might have not been as patient with themselves or their partner as they might like to be. So I love that is the first one that we're talking about.
But all of these attributes are not within a vacuum. They have to be practiced.
Right.
It does not happen overnight.
Right.
I've spent most of my life practicing these. So it takes time.
Right.
The second attribute is empathy. Now, the difference between sympathy, I'm sure you can tell me, the difference between sympathy and empathy, Mona, what do you consider the differences between the two?
Well, I think we can have sympathy for somebody and not feel like we need to necessarily be there for them, help them process it, you know, validate their emotions, where empathy is more the other side of that. That's my feeling about it. Like, well, I can Yeah, go ahead.
So for me, the empathy is recognizing other people's feelings, other people's circumstances, other people's situations without owning the good, the bad, and the ugly of whatever that is. So with empathy, you're not getting involved with their personal business with the other person, but we're being understanding of those circumstances.
I love that.
So now just think for myself, again, I found it easier for me to have empathy for other people than it was to have empathy for myself. My whole life, I minimized all that I went through, all I almost said torment. It was a torment. All the abuse, I minimized it. And I believe I minimized it to survive. It's a survival skill that I no longer need, but sometimes still comes into play. Again, with the accountability and responsibility, I have to look at myself and say, what is objectively the truth? Objectively, I have gone through a lot, so I need to be patient or kind to myself. I need to give myself room to make mistakes in this new realm of understanding that I'm embracing. So I'm literally looking at myself from the outside, not allowing my mind to lie to me or manipulate me and say it's better than or worse than, but what it truly is, so that I can have empathy for myself that would enable me to have compassion for me, for what I'm going through. It's the same for someone else. To have empathy, as I'm sure you've heard, you know, think about walking in that person's shoes for a day.
Right. Yeah. And I think that sometimes when we're in conflict with our partners or family members because they have different perspectives than we do, and we're not giving them the grace and the space that we would want them to give to us, sometimes it's hard for folks to have that empathy. But I love the way you describe that as the self-empathy. I think it has to start with yourself, and then you can have empathy for others. What about the third one, Dennis? What's the third one?
So the third one is jealous, being jealous. So when I look at jealousy, it's interesting. When I was, again, in the monastery, I was at the time ill, and we always were chanting and singing, and there was a nun in my monastery who sang so beautifully. I remember sitting across our chapel from her, listening to her sing. And I was jealous. And in that very moment of jealousy, I realized I'm jealous. I want what she has, but I don't have it.
Mm.
And in that same moment, I thought, well, what do I have? And I realized that when I was jealous, it's because I wasn't grateful for what I do have, nor was I validating or allowing myself to be aware that what I do have has value, even if it's something intrinsic. And from that day forward, I didn't experience jealousy because I chose to be grateful for what I have and to be grateful for what I see the gifts that other people have.
Love that, Dennis. Love that. That's beautiful. Beautiful.
So, thank you.
Yeah.
So you can see how to be really, jealousy is not something that, first of all, it's not going to help us in any way. It doesn't change anything. It just makes us feel worse about who we are. But again, with accountability and responsibility with that particular attribute, when you really assess it, when we're self-reflective, we begin to see life differently. And then, as you know, an attitude of gratitude changes every situation.
Absolutely. I actually have that framed and on my wall, an attitude of gratitude. I love that. So let's talk about 4, 5, and 6. What are those attributes?
They're close too. They're close in the relationship. The fourth is to not be boastful or put on airs or pretend that you're more important than you are. And I find that humility has been a word that I've studied my entire life, and the the most simple definition of humility for me is being honest with self, others, and a higher power. And when we're boastful, it's because we have this ego that's telling us we're less than, and we're not appreciative of what we do have. Now, so it's going back into the other earlier attributes. So we're trying to be more than who we are, which is unnecessary. And we were talking earlier in the podcast about being fearless to be who we are. When we're fearless to be who we are, we don't need to boast.
Right.
We just need to be present.
Right. That's beautiful. And I know for a lot of neurodivergent folks, they've never felt comfortable being who they are. So when they are in that place, yeah, they don't have to compare themselves to other people. They don't have to be jealous or boastful. And wow, what a freeing life you can have when, yeah, when you don't feel jealous or the need to be boastful. I love that. What about five, Dennis? What is five?
So five is to not be proud or arrogant or being egotistical. Again, where your ego is driving you. Your ego always tells you that you're either better than or less than, and it's a lie. So this particular attribute of being arrogant is the furthest from the truth. And if you, again, bring accountability and responsibility into the picture of someone being arrogant, it makes it blatant, the destructive power of arrogance. There's no truth in arrogance. Again, we bring back humility, being honest with self, others, and a higher power.
Mm-hmm.
Arrogance doesn't have accountability and responsibility. It's like, you know, someone who's a snob, or they feel someone that feels superior to others. So that would be the sixth one. And then
that's the fifth one. Yeah. And I want to say something about that, because I do know a lot of neurodiverse couples I've had the opportunity to know, one partner may feel superior to the other because they are able to communicate in a way they think is more appropriate or more respectful, or they may be more emotionally intelligent. And I just want to say to the listeners, you know, because of your differences, you may move into that space of feeling superior. I know I did. I mean, I would look at my ex-husband and judge, you know, why can't you make decisions quicker? Why can't you adjust to change easier? Why can't you share your emotions with me the way I do mine? And that is not a healthy place to be in a relationship. So I appreciate both those, the boastful piece and the pride and arrogance. So six, you said it's somewhat related?
It is. It's being rude or being offensive. And this is where it goes back to really healthy psychology, where in communications, an effective communicator is assertive. That means for me, it's always having a conversation where there's a win-win situation, or we are being respectful of ourselves and the other person, where when we're rude, we're offensive.
Yeah.
And go ahead, Amona.
Yeah, you know, I agree. And oftentimes one of the things I hear, Dennis, is my partner has a tone that feels rude or feels defensive. Okay. And sometimes that needs to be a conversation about. Your partner may not even understand their tone. I know, you know, this can happen with both partners, but it may be a conversation around listening to the words and maybe not so much the tone, or having a check-in regarding your tone and even recording yourself, you know, recording your conversation with your partner and hearing the difference in your tone or their tone. Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's really important, because I know for myself, Stephen has often told me that sometimes I come across when I'm speaking to him as if I'm rude. I'm like, what? It's because of the tone that I'm not even aware. I don't even have that intention or motivation inside of me. I'm trying to do the opposite. And so this is where, for me, in being neurodiverse, a loving relationship like I have with Stephen has, he has been someone where I can be myself while I'm also open to hear him say if I'm coming across a certain way that's negative, then I try to reflect, how is that happening? Because again, I can't fathom that because it's not my intentions, but it's still happening.
Right. Right. And the intention versus the impact is so important in any relationship, but it's such a critical factor in neurodiverse relationships or mixed neurotype relationships because of exactly what you said. Your intention is not to be rude. Your intention is not to have a rude tone or be nasty to your fiance, but that's how it's coming across. So having that conversation so that you can, you know, kind of check in with yourself. Okay. What is a nicer tone I can use, or a better way in which I can share that? And it's a work in progress, Dennis. We're never, ever going to get all these things right. Ever, ever.
No, absolutely. And Mona, what's a challenge for me is that, you know, I love Stephen so deeply that I would not want to come across sarcastic to him, but that's what he's hearing. Mm. And so it's painful because as much as we talk about it, I'm still working on trying to understand, how is it happening? Mm. Fortunately, he knows me very well. He knows I don't lie. And because of that, and I've been consistent my entire relationship with him, it helped him to have a baseline to say, okay, Dennis doesn't lie, but he's doing this. How can I help him? Because he knows that it's not intentional. But that's the relationship that we've developed because we communicate all the time.
I love it. I love it. That's a great lesson for folks that are in mixed neurotype relationships. Okay, let's go on to 7, 8, and 9.
Absolutely. 7th is love is not self-seeking or doesn't insist on its own way. It's non-judgmental and it's intolerant to a lack of charity or kindness. So, and not having your own way doesn't mean that you can't be you. It's just that in a relationship, there's always a balance. And the balance is, if someone says, hey, what would you like to do? Well, I would like to do this. That's not having your own way. That's sharing your experience. But then my partner says, well, I would like to do this. Well, I don't want to do that. I only want to do this other thing. Then I'm forcing myself on someone else. I'm forcing what I want, but I'm also forcing in the sense I'm putting my desire, what I want, above perhaps the need or even the appropriateness of compromising with another person. So I'm literally being selfish and self-centered and self-serving.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's an important one in any time you're in a relationship with another person. Yeah, that's a challenge, I know, for lots of folks. And being kind, I think, is so critical. And I often say, you know, when I find myself getting judgmental, I say to myself, okay, how would I communicate this to my daughter? Because I have a very different way of communicating. It's often not judgmental at all. And it's just filled with love and kindness and unconditional regard for her. So sometimes that's helpful for me, just a thought. Okay, let's go on to 8 and 9.
Sure. Well, just to go back one thing that I, it's this thought that came to my mind when I was going to a funeral of a friend whose wife basically misunderstood me and didn't like me, and they had a death in the family, and I was going. I was really nervous about meeting this woman. And this thought came to me while I was driving, bring my love, not my ego.
Mm.
Bring my love, not my ego. And as soon as that thought came to me, I realized it's my ego that feels bad. I'm supposed to be going there to support them, and I'm worried about myself.
I love that. Love that.
So again, takes the emphasis off of me and puts it where it's supposed to be, in this case, the other people, because I'm going to support them. So now the next attribute, love is not irritable and it's not resentful. Now, I don't know if you ever heard of I think it's called an acronym,
mm-hmm.
HALT. When you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired, don't make any decisions.
Yeah.
Well, because when we're hungry, angry, lonely, tired, we're vulnerable to be irritable. We're vulnerable to fall back into old patterns of behavior. So we want to halt, we want to stop. Well, being irritable is something we need to control because it's not loving. It's we're taking out our lack of self-care and the buildup of the lack of self-care on somebody else.
Yep. And I always say, when you're dysregulated, do not continue talking to your partner or your child or your boss or whoever you're in conversation with, because it's not going to end well. So, yeah.
Amen to that.
Yeah, I love it. All right. 9.
Resentful. Neither, we don't brood over either someone's misfortune, and we don't cast this experience of resentment onto other people, because it's caustic. When we hold resentment is an energy that draws us down into our past behaviors that are unhealthy. And there's that need to let go and let it be what it is, and it's okay.
I love that. And I think, you know, one of the things that I hear often from neurodiverse couples is, you know, I'm not sure if I can forgive. And I think that's tied into the resentful piece. As long as you can't forgive your partner for past mistakes that they made, or you can't forgive yourself, you're going to be resentful. And it's not going to be helpful. Yeah. All right. Let's do 10, 11, and 12. These are excellent. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So love does not rejoice in what is wrong. I think that speaks for itself. But when, like, we've all had experiences of people who have really done harm to us. Well, when some harm comes to them, we don't get excited about it. Say, well, they deserve it. You know, good for, you know, we don't write people off, but we just let it be what it is. Karma takes care of what we sow, we will reap. It's just like karma. But we don't need to have a party over it. We can just allow them to be responsible and accountable for their own behavior and what their behavior brings them. Let it be without us getting involved. The next attribute is, this is a challenging one, because it's in the Bible, it says love bears all wrongs. There's no limit to love and its forbearance. Love requires us to have self-control. It requires us to, in bearing all things, to the degree possible, because none of this is about perfection, to the degree possible, understand that there's a reason for what happens in our life. I was just talking to Stephen the other day, when there's times I've been very ill for years on end, that I always looked at what good is going to come out of this. Mm. So I was able to endure what I was going through without letting it corrupt or harden my heart or prevent me from having healthy relationships.
Well, that is, you know, your mindset is amazing after everything you've been through. And yeah, I do believe that there's an absolute mind-body connection, right? So when our mind is not in a place that is loving and self-affirming and all of those things, I think it does impact our body. And yeah, I think the more we can learn about how we can function in a more loving way towards ourselves, which we talked about earlier, we can create a life that is, you know, filled with opportunities and people who are respectful and kind and compassionate. I love that. So 12,
yes. 12 is love endures all things. So it believes all things, it loves all things, and endures all things. And what that means is, in believing it, we have hope. For me, I think in every situation that occurs to me, no matter what's happening, the good, bad, and the ugly, there's a purpose and a reason, and I'm going to find it. Mm. So that's believing all things are possible, because that's what love does. Love is limitless. So if love is limitless, we believe in all things are possible. We just have to work towards it or put it in our mind or however it is that we do what we do to make our dreams come true. And then also hope. Love hopes all things. Love is so much a part of the universe and the goodness of all things, and even the hidden goodness that is behind trials or pain or suffering, because we need those too. We do need trials, pain, suffering, because those are the attributes that fashion us like a sword. It's, you know, it's put in the furnace, it's red hot, then it's put in cold water, and it fashions the sword to make it stronger.
Yes.
And so when we have that understanding, we can always have hope, because we anticipate somehow the universe making whatever has happened, good, bad, and ugly, come to us and an understanding of there's a reason.
Yes, and it builds resilience. And I will say, because I hear this over and over again from one partner usually in the neurodiverse relationship, and it can be the autistic partner or the non-autistic partner, that they've given up hope. And that's okay. And I just want to normalize that, because, you know, there's going to be grief, because now you understand that the relationship that you thought you were going to have, you may not have moving forward. And I say this a lot on the podcast, Dennis, you know, you can lose hope and regain hope, but it may not be in the relationship that you're currently in. Just like you had to let go of family members and other people that you had known throughout your life because the trauma and the negative energy and all of that. If the relationship you're in is not one that is loving, or even if you love each other, but you're not kind to each other and you don't have hope that you can be with this person moving forward, it's okay, as Dennis and I have talked about, you know, which I think is so important. There are opportunities for growth. There are opportunities for learning and healing. And it doesn't have to be that your life is now filled with regret because your relationship didn't work out. So, right. Yeah. So, and, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And just the last one, it's funny. I'm only now getting it. I spent a lot of time in this. Love endures all things. And as I said early in the podcast, how I minimized my past. And now as I'm writing my autobiography in this book about love, the minimization is not working. And I'm at times I get overwhelmed with my past experience and realizing what truly happened. But in hindsight, I can see that because I did love through all that happened, I was able to endure it, and it brought me to this place where I'm speaking to you now.
Yeah.
And that that last attribute just dawned on me for myself what that means. We can, when we truly love objectively, with accountability and responsibility, we have this incredible strength and power to endure all things. And now, Mona, I'm sharing this with you, and I know I told you about a year and a half ago, I have suffered with chronic pain most of my life, and I was considering taking my life probably 15 months ago, because between the autism, the trauma, and the pain, where there's sometimes I had to crawl down the stairs because I was in so much pain, it's like I lost hope, but I got on my knees and said, okay, God, you know, I need you to do something because I cannot exist like this any longer. And the next day, my life shifted in a whole nother direction. And so that's the love does that. That's how powerful love is.
Wow.
And that's how it enables us to endure.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And Dennis, thank you so much for sharing that, because I know a lot of folks who have shared that they've had suicidal ideations and thought about taking their lives because of the emotional pain and the physical pain they're in. I know a lot of autistic folks that have lots of, you know, medical issues that cause them chronic pain and probably will throughout their lives. So thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate that. 13, 14, and 15, and then we'll wrap up.
Oh, we just finished them all.
Oh,
we did all of them.
Oh, we did all of them. I was numbering them. Maybe I got it wrong. Okay, so that is what the core attributes of love are. And you have a book on this. You're also writing your autobiography. And you have been through so much that you've just, you know, shared in an hour, just barely touched the surface. I would love if there's any examples that you want to share with the audience as we finish the podcast about what love looks like now for you, whether it's in your relationship with Stephen or in your work or whatever. What maybe one or two examples would you want to share with the listeners?
Wow, that's
I know you could so share 100, but just one or
I
two.
Know. Well, it's the idea of, well, I have been practicing this my whole life, and I can say that the relationships that I'm in now because of this, they say love is a universal language. Well, when it's held with accountability and responsibility, and it's mutual, and it follows these laws that exist regardless if we practice them, like the law of mutuality, when you give and receive, the power of that, I experience it to the point that it is bringing healing to me. And it's not only bringing healing to my past, without me even trying, it's reaching what I'm going through because I truly practice the attributes of love. Somehow, I can't totally explain it, but I'm able to be a vehicle of emotional healing for other people. And my whole life has been about serving. Mm-hmm. And to go through what I've gone through and can use it to help other people discover themselves and to discover how beautiful they are for me, that's one of the biggest gifts that I've gotten out of understanding what love looks like, that I can love myself and accept myself, but I can also accept and love other people even in their differences. And I'm willing to discuss it. That's the one thing that I'm willing to. I'm not afraid to ask questions, and I'm not afraid to look foolish in front of other people to get my question answered because I want to know the truth. And I run to the truth. And in doing so, it's been painful at times. It's been glorious. But I'm in an 8-year relationship that every day is continuing to grow. We're both changing. We're both supporting each other in so many different aspects. And I am loved, admired, and cherished as much as I love, admire, and cherish Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the epitome of what every human being desires. Every human being that hasn't hardened their heart desires to be experience mutual love, admiration, joy, peace, happiness. That's what comes from love.
Amen. Amen. That's a beautiful way to end our conversation. And I know, Dennis, there are going to be lots of folks that are going to want to reach out to you, or at least some that are going to want to reach out to you. Is there a place where people can get in touch with you? Do you prefer email? Do you have social media? What would you like to ask?
I have an Instagram account that is Dennis the Monk. And if people want to send an email to me, they certainly can do that too. And you have my email, so somehow maybe you can post it.
I can.
But I'm totally open to, if I can help or serve anyone, it's my honor.
Wonderful. And when do you think your books will be out? Any estimation on year, date, or is it still kind of just a work in progress?
It's still a work in progress because as I'm working, especially the autobiography, the book on love is almost done, but the autobiography, because I'm coming into the intensity of emotions that I have to work through, sometimes I have to stop writing in order to process emotionally sometimes days and weeks, but I'm hoping by the end of next year, I'll have both books published.
Wonderful. All right, Dennis, thank you so much for your vulnerability, for your honesty, for sharing the things, some of the things that you've learned, a little bit about your journey and your lived experiences, and these wonderful attributes of love that I think are going to be helpful for folks to think about on a daily basis in the relationships where they love somebody, but maybe don't always understand them. And they're letting the differences get in the way of fully embracing the love they have for their partner, family member, children, or coworker. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you joining me on the podcast.
Oh, it was my delight. And Moni, so easy to talk to.
Oh, thank you.